Welcome to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? James Caruso in New York. How are you, sir?
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. How are you, Ray?
That's great. I am really excited about our guest today because, frankly, I am a personal fan. I have his book right here. It's The Outlaw Ocean. Fantastic book. We'll plug that. But it's in the title. And so Ian Urbina is the director of the Outlaw Ocean Project. And I'm going to start you right off, sir, with a question is why should we care about the Outlaw Ocean?
Yeah, I mean, I would answer that by first defining the Outlaw Ocean, at least how I think of it. How I approach the realm and the topic is as a frontier, you know, not as a journalistic marine story, but as a realm that's large and has lots of people doing lots of things out there. Much of the things that are going on are extra legal. So they're sometimes illegal and sometimes not really defined or not enforced. And then that's about as far as I tend to go on the broadest notion of the outlaw ocean as a concept. The kind of why we should care, well, lots of reasons. Number one, you know, more than 50 million people work at sea around the world. So this is a huge population of human beings that are engaged in different activities out there. And so just as a kind of ethical concern about their well-being and it as a workplace, that's one major reason. As a marine realm, as an environmental realm, you know, 50% of the air we breathe, 80% of the products we consume traverse the seas, 50% of the air we breathe comes through, you know, cleansed by the oceans, the temperature stabilizer of the planet. So existentially for the planet as a climate concern, the oceans are unbelievably important and especially important, like when you think about how little attention there is on the space, when you put those two things together, their urgency and the issues coupled with the darkness and the lack of attention, it just amps up the reason to care more. And then there's just like amazing story out there in this era we live now where everything is kind of a tap and a click away. And we feel like we kind of know all the stories. You go out to the high seas, as you two know quite well, and there's so much that you will blow your mind, you know, that most people don't know about. And so just from a narrative perspective, people should care because there's just fascinating stuff happening out there.
Maybe, Ian, you could tell us what the three or four most egregious examples of illegal and extra legal activity are.
I mean, I can just cite the ones that I've covered over the last, you know, decade and a half. Human slavery, a huge issue in the distant water fishing fleet. So this is, you know, folks all the way to, from shackled while not working on fishing vessels to softer versions of human trafficking and debt bondage and captivity, but a really major problem on the distant water fishing vessels that that sort of sift the high seas. Murder with impunity, you know, spent about 7 years on one case in particular, which was illustrative and compelling journalistically because there was footage of the actual murder of anywhere from 5 to 12 guys. And the notion that you can kill, there can be evidence at the end of the video, these guys even posed for selfies. From a journalistic or law enforcement point of view, you'd think that would be an easy open and closed case. And yet 7 years it took for us to finally get a prosecution. That's another example. Those are the dramatic ones. In some ways, the more urgent ones are the slow motion, less dramatic ones. So, you know, overfishing, illegal fishing, a kind of creeping ubiquitous crime, but one that's like really severe when it comes to the overall outlook of the planet. The only reason the oceans can cleanse and produce 50% of the air we breathe isn't because of the water. It's because of the marine life. They're the ones doing the work. So if we rake those oceans clean of all that biodiversity, there goes that 50% cleansing. So these are crimes that are less dramatic, but pretty severe, and we cover them regularly. But abuse of migrants crossing the Mediterranean and sort of outsourcing by the European Union to failed states like Libya to sort of do things at sea that you can't get away with on land, another kind of category of crime that we've covered. Repo men of the ocean who steal ships on behalf of banks. Interesting, bizarre, another category of extra legal behavior happening at sea. So it's varied, and a lot of them are pretty severe.
Ian, so you've opened up a lot of boxes there, and I want to focus on one in particular, which is this whole idea of overfishing. Anyone who's been out on an airplane and looked out the window as you cross the Pacific Ocean or something knows that the ocean is just this huge, vast place. And it seems almost counterintuitive to believe that we could actually that we could pull all the fish out of this place, that we could somehow denude this incredibly large space of fish. How serious a problem is this, and how exactly does it happen?
Yeah, I mean, you put it well. It is an expansive place, and it's one of, that fact is one of the reasons that we are where we are now, right? The notion of it being so huge has given rise to the notion that it's forever replenishing, and sort of everything that you do out there will essentially be diluted. You know, for a long time, the environmental motto was dilution is the solution to pollution. And there was a legal and normal practice of dumping what you can't dump on land, you dump at sea, nuclear weapons and arms of other sorts and oil rigs and whatever you wanted, you could get away with dumping at sea because it was not legal, not illegal for a long time. Okay, so now shift to marine life. The misnomer of that infinity, of that expanse, is that it's a desert. The reality under the water is that it's not robustly populated by legions of fish everywhere. So the fish and the biodiversity that's in the water is in isolated patches, and there are huge expanses where they aren't. So it's a bit of a misconception that's conveyed by the expanse of it all. Point one. Point two, the industrial capacity of fishing has excelled wildest imaginations. So the amount of tonnage that you can pull out of the water in any given month by a pair trawler, you know, two ships that string a massive net between them, it's shocking how much you can pull out. And really, to make money in industrial or large-scale fishing, it's a tonnage game. You really have to pull huge amounts out for you to succeed, except for specialized things like tuna and, you know, really high value. But squid or fish meal or these sorts of things, like you have whitefish, pollock, you have to pull massive quantities. The technology increase and the increases in technology were multifaceted. So number one, the ships got larger, the engines got more efficient, the nets got larger, the microfilament, the stuff that the nets are made of, became much stronger, but also the tech became incredibly sophisticated. You know this well, but no longer is fishing a sort of game of chase. It's really closer to, it's less like hunting and more like harvesting. So the tech now is you go out and you collect. You're not like trying to find them. We already know where they are. The schools of fish are known. You know, the ships have incredible radar. Satellites are used. Even FADs, which are these floating hunks of flotsam, have tech on them so that this big chunk of net and other debris serves as an attraction point where lots of fish begin. These are fish aggregating devices is what FADs stand for. And there are, you know, tens of thousands of them. And they float around and fishing captains put them out, and often they have tech on the top of them, which actually is monitoring the biomass underneath the FAD. And when it reaches a certain point, i.e. the school of fish that's circling it, hiding out from predators, gets large enough, a text message goes to the guy at the bar who's waiting for the alert as to when to go out and collect. That's not hunting, that's harvesting, right? The crop is now ready, now cut it down. So that shift is what in the last two, three decades, especially, but four decades has caused for, you know, a third of all the world's stocks to be at or beyond the point of collapse.
You know, Ian, when I was posted out in Southeast Asia, we used to talk to governments about these problems. And the response of the government officials was twofold. One, we have a big growing population that eats protein at low cost, and this is the best way to do it. Two, our population doesn't care about these things. Only you Westerners do. And, you know, you can afford to put turtle extruder devices on your tuna fleet. We can't afford that. So why don't you go and worry about your own problems and leave us alone?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and both completely legitimate points, but somewhat shallow, right? Like not really thinking a couple moves down the chessboard. So if you're the, you know, president of Palau and you make those two points, I see where you're coming from. But now let's play this out a little bit. So if your folks don't really care a whole lot about this Western claim, and you're really just trying to get by next week, either in the form of not angering your local artisanal guys who want to go out and catch what they will for tonight's dinner or next week's dinner. But you're also, as the president, trying to build some schools and some roads and deal with COVID and whatnot, right? You're trying to get some revenue. So you're now selling licenses to the rich Westerners or the Asians, right, who have the big industrial boats. And that's your twofold plan. Keep the local guys happy for this week and keep the economy running by dealing with the bigger Western wealthy guys and Asian wealthy guys for this year. You're forgetting what happens in 5 years, which is all the fish for your local guys are going to be gone. And now you're going to have a serious, serious problem. So your protein source and your policy is not really sustainable. This is the problem of the political cycle. It's not just in the US, it's everywhere, right? So the guy who's in office now will be out of office in 4 years, and that problem is going to land in 9 years. So he's just trying to basically get 8 years, a second term, but the check comes due in 9 years, which is 1 year outside his second term, right? And this is the nature of the political cycle and the nature of short-sighted policy decisions. So then the Western academics and whoever come in and start lecturing this long game argument, and it feels really colonial and esoteric and self-interested and liberal and all these things. But it also might be true. You know, all those things may be the case, but it also might be spot on. And in 9 years, your stock is going to collapse and you're going to have a serious crisis. You might be out of office, but if you're a good office holder, you care about what happens, you know, 10 years down the road, not just eight. So this is, you know, good economists will come in and also add in, okay, wait, like, even if you view this from a local perspective and your own self-interest, forget the liberal Western kind of enviros who are trying to push their agenda on you, you could make a lot more money with shark tourism than shark finning, right? Like you keep the fish in the water and yeah, you're going to anger some local guys who want to sell that fish tomorrow for dinner, but you're going to have three more guys who are actually got a sustainable model of tourism. And those guys are probably going to donate to your campaign and keep you in office and keep the economy going more than the guy who's really angry at you, who's the local fisherman. So you kind of have to do some analysis, even domestically, to think about what's the bigger picture here. And usually when you do the bigger picture, it adds up to you got to slow down the pace of the extraction. And normally those arguments are not like heavily burdensome on the artisanal guys, the locals. It's normally heavily burdensome on the industrial foreign guys. And those are revenue sources. You still get pushback, but those are not normally like, you know, opposed by locals for reasons of, we just want to feed our people. Normally it's like, it's opposed by the lobbyists who want to bring in the tax revenue because they just landed a big deal with the French fleet, the Spanish fleet, the Chinese fleet, whomever, and they just cut a big deal and they get a piece of that action.
And one of the main the main things that we do at Sea Light is track ships. And so when I'm out tracking ships, one of the things that I'm always looking at is these huge gatherings of fishing vessels in interesting places, say the Arabian Sea or off the coast of Peru. And what I notice about them is that they almost all of them come from the same country, which is China. You mentioned before the distant water fishing fleet. What is the distant water fishing fleet, China's distant water fishing fleet? And is what I'm seeing on ship tracking, is that really representative of how vast it is?
I'll go to the second one first because it's easier. No, it's an undercount. What you're seeing is a percentage, what it is, maybe 60, if I had to guess, percent of what actually is out there, because a lot of the actual clusters are dark, you know, they're vessels that have their transponders off. So you're never seeing more than exist. You're always seeing less than exist. Yeah, China is the superpower of seafood. You know, if you believe, well, first let's define the term. So distant water fishing fleet, by the traditional like FAO, UN definition, a distant water vessel is a vessel that is fishing either on the high seas, so international waters, or in a foreign nation's waters, excluding the neighboring side nations of the flagship. So you're China and your ship is in the, or you're Angola and your ships are in the adjacent waters. It's an Angolan flag, but you're in, help me on the geography here, Senegal, or I'm not good at my African geography, but you're in the neighbor's waters. You're actually not officially a distant water fishing fleet by the UN definition. By our definition, when it came to China, we actually included, because China's so big, Chinese flag vessels that are on the high seas or in other countries' waters, even if those other countries are neighbors. Okay, now that's your definition. Typically, these are larger ships. They're industrial ships, crews of 20 to 100. They often stay at sea for very long periods of time. So that can be 6 months to 3 years. We had interviews with some crew who had been out for three straight years. That's facilitated by transshipment vessels. So these are refrigeration ships that go out, they pick up the fish, they drop off ice and fuel and parts and food and whatever. And then they go back and bring the catch back to shore for processing. But the fishing vessel keeps fishing, you know, for 2-3 years at a time. The industrial distant water fishing fleet is really the big player when it comes to the ocean's depletion. Those are really the drivers, right? And China is hands down the biggest. They're bigger than the next three combined. Okay, so, you know, if you believe the Chinese government's numbers, they say their distant water fishing fleet, by their more traditional definition, is 2,700. That's an undercount as far as we're concerned. There are some think tanks out there that put the actual number up at 17,000. We think that's an overcount. The number where we came and we worked on it for a good year in scrubbing data is 6,500, 7,000 vessels. The next largest fishing, distant water fishing fleet is under 300. Okay, so gives you a sense of scope. And the Chinese fleet isn't just bigger in their number. They're bigger in how long they stay at sea, how big a group they tend to travel in, the amount of subsidies that come in and keep them financially afloat, the types of indirect subsidies, armed guard ships, medical hospital ships, you know, refueling ships that travel around the world with the fleets. Most other world's fleets don't have those added supports, those subsidies, direct and indirect, like China does. And all that explains. And then the last way in which China is the superpower is on land. So when it comes to seafood, the processing capacity that China has is, you know, far beyond anyone else. So even all the fish that's coming off of Chinese vessels is ending up processed in China, virtually all, 95%. Then a lot of stuff that's processed, say, on American ships, Canadian ships, French ships, gets brought back to land by the host country and then frozen, shipped to China for processing, processed, frozen again, shipped back, and then often sold, caught locally, because it was caught locally, but it was processed over there. So China is the powerhouse in seafood.
Are these private companies doing this? Or is this the state? Why would China be subsidizing this industry?
Everyone subsidizes, or the big players subsidize. Spain, Ukraine, Russia, France, South Korea, they're all in Taiwan in the subsidies game. China is much more so. Why do they subsidize? There's an incredible study that came out maybe 3 years ago that looked at all the high seas fleets and found that the overwhelming majority of high seas fleets would not be at all, even nearly profitable, were it not for subsidies. Why does China subsidize, or why does anyone subsidize? But in China's case, huge, as you said before, James, like huge growing middle class, huge population to feed, a desire to be independent economically, food security wise, and China's really trying to not rely on other protein sources that could put them in a vulnerable situation if, I don't know, billions of dollars of tariffs were dropped on them, for example. And so they're constantly trying to consolidate control over their vital resources, like their protein source. And then geopolitics, you know, the Chinese fishing fleet is a proxy player for many other things. South China Sea, Chinese vessels that don't even fish are there flexing muscle to push back and sort of by numbers bully Malaysia, Vietnam, Indonesia, et cetera, all these players. The fishing fleet is also in places that are less heated than the South China Sea, but also geopolitically sensitive. The Chinese fleet is putting a lot of vessels in there to establish facts on the ground, to establish precedent. We've been there for three decades. Here's the historical data that proves it. And for that reason, we should have extra voting power when it comes to this big treaty about this RFMO, the Regional Fisheries Management Organization, or our quota should be twice that of the Chileans because we have 12, you know, years of established precedent and double the number of fishing fleet. These sorts of things give them more say in key governing bodies if they've been there a while. So all those reasons are why they are, and they're just big eaters of seafood. And it's a hugely profitable on land. The subsidies of the ships is one thing, but the seafood industry writ large is a different economic analysis. And seafood as an industry is a big employer in China, especially in key, you know, coastal states, Shandong province in particular, that have important power brokers. So it's hard to eradicate those jobs without angering key players, and the fishing industry and Shandong province have some very important key players that you don't mess with them.
Ian, a lot of your recent work that I've seen has focused in on the human rights abuses. And I'm particularly fascinated by the crew who are brought aboard these ships, whether they be from China or somewhere else. Who are the people who are being victimized, and how is it happening? And you know, what are these abuses, and how is it sort of transpiring? Who's involved?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say is, you know, before I worked on China, I worked on other places, one of which was the Thai fleet. And the Thai fleet in the South China Sea has a robust history of human trafficking and horrific violence and abuse of crew, mostly Cambodian, Laotian, Burmese, Rohingya. So I don't want to act as if China's unique by any means. Some of the worst cases I've looked at were South Korean vessels off the coast of New Zealand, the Ouyang fleet. However, China is bigger and more misbehaving than any other fleet on the planet. And on the human rights issue, the story is well, we focus, and I'm most knowledgeable about the squid fleet, so have not done much work on China's tuna longliners or its fishmeal vessels, or I know a lot about the squid fleet. Squid fleet's the biggest. They're in the most interesting places. Those vessels pre-COVID were typically a squid jigger might have, hoy no, estoy bien, gracias. Those folks may be a vessel of 40 to 50 guys. Pre-COVID, it would be maybe 10 Chinese nationals in the officer ranks. And then below it, it would be probably Indonesian, Filipino, or African crew. The typical abusive scenario would be, number one, those workers were probably hired and recruited by a third entity called a manning agency. And it's an employment firm. It's usually not in the country that owns the ship or that is flagging the ship. It's usually some other country. In this case, a lot of these manning agencies will be in Indonesia. They'll be recruiting small villagers who aren't super savvy, haven't traveled. Maybe they've never even been on a ship. They're inland folk. And they're easier to sort of move through the process. They ask fewer questions. And they get recruited. They get funneled through this recruitment process. The manning agencies handle logistics, contracts, finding the guys, et cetera. If things go awry and the guy needs to get off the ship, the manning agency is supposed to handle it. So China was largely using manning agencies and mostly foreign crew. the you know, a standard debt bondage model. These guys have not a penny to their name. They rack up a debt just to get the job. They often have to pay fees to qualify for it. So they're already in debt even before they board the ship. And then there are hidden fees within their contract. So they think they're going in making $200 a month, and they're actually making $10 a month because of all the hidden fees and the debt they got to pay off. And then there are these insane clauses like you're allowed to sell guys ship to ship, totally legal and in the contract. Usually the contracts are written in languages that the crew doesn't read, so they have no idea what they're saying. If the guy leaves the ship before the contract's up, these are usually 2-year contracts, then he has to pay for his home flight home, and he doesn't get a huge percentage of the wages he's accrued. So pretty 19th century contracts, if you will. This is what trafficking looks like from a paper point of view. And then the reality on the ships is the other sort of part of the equation. Criminal level neglect, you know, diseases that shouldn't still be caught by people, much less killing them, like beriberi, which is like scurvy, but it's B1, thiamine deficiency. It's a terrible way to die. It's slow motion. It's easily reversed. No one should be dying. It's, you know, you're just not eating things that have enough vitamin B in it. And a lot of guys are dying from B1, from beriberi. Extreme violence, just, you know, having interviewed hundreds of guys over the years, just the normalcy of beatings, and worse, disappearances at sea. So this is typically what happens. Post-COVID, it was very tough to get foreigners, right? Everything locked down, including in China. And so the fleet largely switched to Chinese crew. But interestingly, if you look at what type of Chinese, it was the same game, if you will. It was inland, easily bamboozled, very poor Chinese, not coastal, dock savvy, you know, guys that were being recruited. And, you know, again, we mined amazing recruitment ads in the Chinese social media sphere to see how they were recruiting. And they target, you know, we have one ad where it's like, are you divorced? You know, are you in debt? Do your parents, you know, think ill of you? Come work for me on this switch. I mean, they're just really aiming at folks that are at their most desperate phase.
So we have at least, say, 7,000 Chinese vessels, say an equal amount of third country vessels. We have international treaties and agreements that are supposed to monitor these sort of misbehaviors and protect the fishing stock. But how do you do that? It's just too big a number, and monitors aren't available, and monitors are suborned. Is there an answer?
Yeah, I mean, so I always take one step back before three forward. I'd say there are a couple of problems. One is what rules that exist are often treaties and agreements. These are not often laws. So even how much fish you're allowed to take and from where and when and using what gear, et cetera, those are often codified in kind of consensus agreements. And if you don't want to be a signatory to that management agreement, then you don't have to, you know, so you already have a challenging structure where people can opt in or opt out of the mediocre set of rules that exist. Then add to that, even where the rules do exist, whether they're treaties or laws or agreements, the policing of it is non-existent relatively, because especially on the high seas, who's got jurisdiction? That they belong to no one. So you can bellyache about it at the WTO or at the ILO or lots of different bodies, you know, that you can raise a stink about it, but it doesn't get a whole lot done. It takes forever. And you've got to be a nation that has the resources that wants to do that bellyaching. In other words, if you're Senegal, you're not looking at the budget that hires the specialized lawyer who flies to the meetings and wherever to write a formal complaint. The poor nations that are most targeted don't have the resources to actually play the game, to do what weak options they have to do. And then the rich nations, you know, they sort of also don't really see the returns as worth the effort. So yeah, your problem was, so what do you do about it? You know, I think that there's a lot to be done from different directions in an incremental fashion. So one is, if you think of the world and you think of the problem of a lack of governance at sea and abuse of humans and overfishing and illegal fishing, you have governments and then you have market players and then you have civil society, at least in how I sort of divide up the world. Civil society, you've got people like us, journalists, right, who are bringing attention to it and talking about it and shame, name and shame, and lots of different tactics in the public sphere. And NGOs have lawyers who can sue and NGOs that can, you know, gear up campaigns, et cetera. Okay, then governments, they can issue sanctions and they can file formal complaints and they can also sue and these sorts of things. And then the market players are, not because I'm some Adam Smithian kind of faithful of the market solves all, but because the market does seem to have players that have the ability, they have self-interest, they're the ones benefiting from it, and they can move a lot faster. They're command economies. A corporation is a command structure, right? It's like the military. And so if a company decides that they're no longer going to get seafood of a certain sort, unless the players in their supply chain agree to these certain really stringent standards, that's actually, in my humble opinion, probably going to get changes much faster than if France and the US and Canada and South Korea get together and file a formal complaint about some misbehavior in some place. I think Walmart or the DOD, you know, purchasing office or the EU purchasing office or Whole Foods decides, look, we're not going to get any squid that comes out of Shandong unless it can show us a proof of X, Y, and Z, suddenly the market will start shifting. And those, the government of China, to your earlier question, James, about 60% of those squid vessels are owned by companies that are wholly or partially owned by the government. So it's a mix as much in China as these days. But those sorts of leverages will probably cause, through companies, cause governments to shutter and other companies on the receiving end, ship owners and processing plants and these sorts of things, to realize, look, if we want to keep having profit, then we're going to have to change how we do things.
So do you see any of this happening? I mean, tell us a happy story. What's give us some good news about the outlaw ocean.
No, I mean, a lot of it's happening in lots of discrete, what seem like small bore ways. Look, this China investigation that my team and I just finished, it took 4 years. We went out to sea and got on Chinese vessels in four places: high seas Galapagos, high seas Falkland Islands, coast of West Africa, and sea border of North Korea. Getting on vessels, checking out their supply chain, supposed traceability, checking out conditions of the workers, and a bunch of other things. Bundled that together with a couple of years of intense supply chain dot connecting. So we've got a vessel. This guy died here from beriberi. Then another guy 6 months later died of crush marks under really sketchy circumstances. Oh, and by the way, this vessel was in North Korean waters where their UN sanctions are not allowed to be. Okay, we got a bad player, a scofflaw vessel. Now let's connect that vessel to the end consumer. That's tough, really tough with seafood. But if you follow the bouncing ball and you know how to do it, then you can accomplish it. Who owns the vessel? Where did the seafood go? The refrigeration vessel, follow the refrigeration vessel back to port. It gets in port, have a guy on the ground, follow the truck from the vessel all the way to the plant. Now you got the plant name, use certain databases and codes. Now you know where they exported. Now you go to the recipient. Now you got them to Walmart or Red Lobster or whatever. Okay. All that extra work matters, because if you're going to lean on market players, you have to identify the market players. We did that with the China investigation, and that's why it took 4 years, but it's had massive impact. Three global Magnitsky petitions, which is a huge tool in the US government to sort of sanction companies and individuals. Customs and Border are already working on withhold release orders, meaning these 10 companies, we have to vet it and make sure we can survive legal challenge. But if we can, and these reporters have done their job right, then we're going to stop imports from those companies. CEO resigned, bunch of big players severed ties to certain plants because they were tied to certain ships or forced labor in the plants, Uyghurs and North Koreans. So we've had like massive impact from that project. And if you look at one of them, it feels small bore. But if you look at the whole, I mean, just 3 days ago, an article ran in in South Korea about high-level meetings between Chinese and North Korean officials about what they're going to do about this huge investigation about their seafood industry and forced labor at every stage. So this is getting up to the very highest level. And it affects also, you know, when I started, illegal fishing was defined in a specific way that had to do with fishing. But the claim I humbly put forward and was not the first was that don't the fishers matter as much as the fish? And if you have murder or debt bondage or slavery or whatever on the vessel while they're doing this work, shouldn't that be part of categorizing that product as illegal? And so shouldn't illegal fishing incorporate that? Now it's in, you know, it's codified in law. And when NOAA is assessing, when National Oceanic Atmospheric Organization is assessing which species should have a higher burden of proof when it comes into the U.S., one of the things they consider isn't just, is that species at the risk of running out or is it more prone to illegal fishing? It's also, is that species and that part of the world and those ships more prone to human rights abuses? And if so, it factors into the definition. So these are all different ways where you could point to successes.
So I always assumed that my dolphin safe tuna was a success, but then someone told me that's just advertising. What's right?
More the latter than the former. I think all things being equal, why not go with that label? Because it might be a little bit better than the alternative, but is it actually dolphin safe? There's a lot of reporting and we're actually looking into it now that because again, the devil in the details is often like, well, this can of tuna, only 1/10 of it has to have, and I'm making up these numbers, but the structure is accurate. A small percentage of it actually has to be traceable in this way that allows you to say dolphin free, but the rest of it can come from wherever, right? So these are examples of things that are in the details where when you do get the end product, it might be overstating the confidence you should have in it. And there are a bunch of others. So the MSC, Marine Stewardship Council, and dolphin-shaped tuna, these are the two big, hey, this is better kind of brands of approval, and they're really flawed.
Ian Urbina, he is the director of the Outlaw Ocean Project. Where can people follow your work, and what can they do to contribute?
Theoutlawocean.com is our home site, and there's a little link for a newsletter that's free. And whenever we have a big investigation, we send it out through the newsletter. And then if people think, oh, this is worthy, all of our content is free. We fundraise and cover it. But a lot of that comes from average readers who think this is worthy journalism. And so they sign up to give, you know, $5 a month or something for the newsletter, even though you don't have to pay. So we get support that way. And if you just click on the subscribe button, it'll give you that option.
Well, Ian, thank you so much. We are an Indo-Pacific podcast, and anyone who knows the Indo-Pacific knows that it is a lot about water. And so what you have brought to us today has been extremely important and helpful, and I think will be new to a great number of our listeners, but also very, very fascinating. So it's fascinating work. I recommend your book. It's very, very readable and will open up a whole new world to you if you haven't seen it. Thank you, sir. And we hope you can come back and join us again in the future.
I'd like that. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ian. So that was very interesting, Ray. He's a guy out there trying to do the right thing, and the world needs more folks like that.
Yeah, if you read his book, you find out, I mean, just how, he's... It really is. He's out on the front lines in literal ways. I mean, he's out there, you know, and it's not just him. It's his whole team and people like him putting themselves really in harm's way because the conditions on these ships are obviously very, in many cases, extremely bad. And sometimes the ships that they get involved in, he tells a story of basically a ship trying to chase down one of these scofflaw vessels, as he calls them, and has this long chase that takes months to try to actually, you know, bring this particular bad actor to justice, as it were. So the people involved, it really is fascinating. And you know, the Outlaw Ocean's a good name for it, because in a lot of ways, it's like an old Western, and, you know, in our sort of parlance, there's sort of there's the law of the jungle sort of at play.
So I met a guy in Australia he's huge, about 6'4", built like a something brick house. And one job he had when he was younger was being a monitor on a Australian fishing vessel, to monitor how much fish they caught. So he'd be on the ship for weeks. And basically they told him, you report what we want you to report, or you're not going home. You'll go home and then you'll disappear.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I mean, it really is awful stuff. And, you know, again, because I stare at ship tracks all day long, I really do. I mean, Ian indicated that I'm, of course, not looking at all of them, and that's true. But the numbers really are kind of staggering. And when you see these aggregations of huge numbers of ships, just sort of, and they're usually where you see them, when they actually do have their transponders turned on, is right outside of somebody's exclusive economic zone. So usually that's the way it's working. Now, it's different in a place like the South China Sea, where China claims everything. And so they're a little bolder in places like that. So they believe they have a right to be in certain places, which is in somebody else's exclusive economic zone, since they claim it as part of their big nine dash line claim. But I mean, just to see all of these ships gathered again off the coast of Peru, or, you know, it really is kind of, and then you'll see going back and forth these waves of ships, you know, and then these fish carriers. So a lot of what happens is the fish carriers go back and forth constantly. And so these ships end up staying out, as he indicated, not just for months, but oftentimes for years. And, you know, if you read the book or you read some of his work, one of the things you find out is one of the reasons they don't go into port is because the crew runs away. And so, you know, you might actually get inspected by somebody. So they stay out to sea for these long, long periods of time, and they only go back to port in their home port because that's the place that they feel safe.
So one thing the U.S. government's tried to do, especially for these island nations with huge ocean areas, is give them data from maritime domain awareness. So yeah. Some of the stuff you look at, we give to these countries. So even if they know where the ships are, however, they don't have a Coast Guard that can monitor all this. So they say, we know where the ships are. We know what they're probably doing, but what can we do about it?
Yeah.
So it's a huge mess of a problem.
Well, as we speak, peek behind the curtain. We're right now, we're in the middle of May. We haven't, this episode probably won't air for a little bit, but I am currently watching some drama around Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea, in which is a place that is has long, you know, a long time ago, or, you know, over a decade ago, it was fished sort of commonly, mostly by Chinese and Filipino fishermen. But in 2012, of course, China took control of the shoal, and the Filipino fishermen, who are he used the word artisanal or indigenous fishermen, they're out in small little boats, and they fish to feed their families and maybe to make some money so that they can, it's subsistence fishing. And they are absolutely being crowded out by these huge industrial fishing vessels. And so you're seeing the human cost is not just in the people who work on the ships, but oftentimes these fishing villages all up and down the coasts of these countries, who all of a sudden the fish are all gone. They can't get to them, or they are actually being taken out of the ocean. And again, I sort of grew up with the idea that the vast ocean, right? There's just, assuming there were just unlimited fish in the ocean because the ocean is so huge. And what we're finding out is that we actually can take all the fish away. And we really are coming to a point where in many places, fish stocks are absolutely collapsing. And so, you know, we're getting to a point where everybody's going to have to take this seriously very, very soon. And by the time we actually get there, it may be too late for a lot of people.
I'm going to stock up on tuna fish now.
All right. Well, we better start wrapping this up, Jim. I know that you've got a little bit of a, you're a little under the weather today. So I want to make sure we get you back into bed with something that's humanely raised and made into soup.
Free range chicken soup. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, thank you, Ray. I appreciate that. This is a really interesting program. You still want to tell a little story or?
Oh yeah, that's right. We need to do There I Was. So let's talk about the water, but we'll talk about a lake in Alabama, where I went to Squadron Officer School. This was back in the 90s, and I was a captain, and one of the other captains in my flight was a guy from Bahrain, and he was an F-16 pilot. His name was Yusuf, and everybody knew that Yusuf was an F-16 pilot because Yusuf made sure to tell you that he was an F-16 pilot. And he was, you know, constantly sort of reminding everyone that, you know, that, hi, I'm Yusuf, I fly the F-16. And so one day we all went out together to a lake, all our entire flight, and we go out to this lake, and we're all students in the squadron officer school, and they decide to rent a boat to go water skiing. And so all the people who knew how to water ski were out there water skiing. And Yusuf was very interested in water skiing, but the, you know, had not experienced it before. And so they talked him into it, and he gets on, you know, gets the life vest on, and he, you know, gets behind the boat. And everybody says, okay, now watch, because, you know, the first time somebody water skis, it's always hilarious, right? And the boat gets going, and he gets up on the skis, and he just goes back and forth and back and forth. And everyone was amazed. He never fell down. He never wiped out. And so he comes back, and he says, well, that was fun. And they said, Yusuf, that was amazing. Everybody falls. Everybody falls the first time. And Yusuf says, that? Anyone can do it. Not anyone can fly the F-16. So that was my friend Yusuf. He's a great guy. I got to see him several years later in Bahrain, and he took me out to a very nice dinner that went very, very late at night, because if you've ever been to the Gulf States or in that part of the world, you know that people don't go to bed at normal times. They sleep during the day because it's too hot, and they stay up very late at night. So when he invited me out to dinner, and we went out, and he said, we'll meet at 10 o'clock. And I was like, PM? So yeah, so that was a very long and exhausting dinner, but that was my friend Yusuf. All right, Jim, we need to get you to bed, and we need to put this podcast to bed. This has been Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Specifically, Why Should We Care About the Outlaw Ocean with Ian Urbina. For Jim, I am Ray, and I also want to give a shout out to our producer, Ian Ellis-Jones, who does a fantastic job. Makes us look great, even though we don't necessarily feel great all the time. But thanks, Ian. And we ask everyone out there, if you're enjoying what you're hearing on these podcasts, please subscribe. It helps us out. It'll help you out because you won't have to think about it. It'll just appear there in your podcast feed or in your YouTube channel. And we you know, if you feel like it, go ahead and give us a 5-star review and tell us we look great. We'll see you next time on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?